Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
ceramics. I'm going to give a general introduction to ceramics and put it in the context of things you may know and things you mightn't know. So I'll talk about the fundamental inter-atom bond and how that's classified, and then what makes up a ceramic, and then see if I can actually get the old memory cells going through a ceramic, and some incredible ceramics which are coming out here. So in general, the great thing about ceramics are that they can achieve high temperature without necessarily breaking. Some can. So they can be quite hard, or they can be soft. And in general, they can be good insulators, but they can also conduct. This is so much things. They can be magnetically inert, or they can be the most powerful magnets ever. And because of the way that they're made, they've got this ability to create these properties. It's a great sort of mixing canvas of chemical properties. But let's get back to see if I can explain some of the basics. So all things are made of atoms. So if I get something and I rip it atom by atom, I can put it in little boxes into 118 boxes, filling up the periodic table. And some atoms can be towards the left-hand side of the periodic table, and they tend to be what we call metallic. And it's hard to say, because we declare it and then we talk about metallic properties. It's sort of a bit of a circular argument. On the right-hand side, you get things which tend to be non-metallic, non-metals. And it's all looking in at the individual atom. So let's pan back a bit and let's consider what an atom is. An atom is a nucleus of very small but heavy particles, protons and neutrons. The protons are positively charged, the neutrons have no charge whatsoever. However, they've got a colour charge, so to speak. So in terms of the nuclear force, the neutrons basically provide the glue, basically the substance for efficient gluons to make a stable nucleus. And so the nucleus is very small. Nucleus is generally about a billionth the size of an atom in terms of volume, about a thousandth the size in physical size. So if I had a cubic meter, basically you can imagine a bathtub, and I had a grain of coffee seed, but you know, something a small seed, a millimeter by a millimeter, that would give you the rough size of things. Now, why that's so is that it's due to quantum mechanics. The Schrodinger wave equation says that the existence wave, the wave function, is inversely proportional to the mass. So the size of it. So something which is very light is very big, its existence wave function. This is one of the things when you're trying to visualize it. Quantum mechanics, school physics, everything's nice and solid, so like a little model which I show you, a draw on the board is what you see. But actually when you look at it under a microscope, and you can actually feel it under microscopes, see atoms under microscopes, they don't have hard surfaces, they've got fuzzy boundaries, because they are made of wave functions, and the wave function of existence, that is, it comes into existence and out of existence. It's sort of like, it's like a function. It says how much it exists at every single point of a time. It doesn't have an existence within a point or at a point. Its existence exists over a point. And so we've got atoms. And the different atoms, as you add more protons to it, you go up the periodic table. So hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, copper, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, sodium, magnesium, aluminium, silicon, phosphorus, sulfur, chlorine, argon, potassium and calcium. They're the first 20 that you talk about. But as you go up, that's 1 to 20, you add one more, you add another electron. Now, because the electrons have to always do rule of folding. You can't add one. Almost a rule of folding is sort of folding in a dimension that you can hardly imagine, which is called spin. But after each two electrons, spin up, spin down, next electron has to be folded. And how do you actually fold electrons? Like folding paper napkins. They fold in such a way that they sit on the outside or are easy to remove, which are metals, or they are such that you can actually add another electron into it and it will actually slip into an available fold, and that will be a non-metal like a fluorine or chlorine. And there's sort of two consequences to it. There's one of the amount of energy liberated. So if you imagine a lithium ion, which is group 3, group 1, it's got 3 protons in it. Now it has the property, if it was an ion, so when I say the word ion, I mean it's a particle with an unbalanced number of protons and electrons. It's a positive ion if it's missing one electron, so it's one extra positive charge not enough electrons. If you have another electron around in free space, that electron will go, bloody hell, that's a positive charge, I'm a negative electron, and it will actually go, and it won't bounce around the surface, it will actually completely envelop and sit through that lithium, and you have to imagine how it does it. And the way it does it is that it comes and folds itself, and it unfolds, going bing, 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 emitting light as it comes down to rest on it. It's the most amazing thing. And that's the amount of energy. And it is a light amount of energy to go in and a light amount of energy to go out. Now, you have the similar thing with, say, your chlorine. Now, chlorine is the one which I've picked because it's got the greatest strength of any time. And the electron comes in, and it can see through the folds, it can see a bristling, big, juicy, positive nucleus, and can actually fall in. And say if it's Cl plus chlorine, that's the symbol for chlorine, that electron will fall in. But there's even more to it. This is where all chemistry comes. It's called electron affinity. You can have a neutral chlorine, but when you get up close to it, it's like the Death Star, going up to it, at a certain angle, you can see into the core of that chlorine, and if you're an electron, you can actually land in through the surface, and the chemical reaction, chlorine neutral plus an electron, goes to Cl minus, releases energy. That's the core of chemistry. And so what you can do is you get your lithium, and the lithium can have its electron pulled away from it. So its electrons all the way through, it's pulled away from it, and it can go into the core of the chlorine. And that releases energy, it's stable, it's a preferred thing. So a Cl, lithium plus, Li plus, and a Cl minus, form a stable pair. The electrons prefer to say, I'm leaving you, lithium, I prefer to stay in this chlorine because I can zip through the quantum wave functions and get closer. That's the basis of a ionic bond. And this whole series of different bonds, depending on how you get to it, but this releases a certain amount of energy. The energy required to ionize the lithium is paid for, but more than compensated by the energy of electron going into the chlorine atom. So it's this enormous thing. Now, the interesting thing is that this is not taught at school. Why not? Well, that's something for the historians to look at. There are certain things that Romans believed in, the superstition and things like this. It's really, chemistry is taught a little bit by superstition. But that property, that energy of an electron going into a neutral atom, is called the electron affinity. And if you get onto the periodic table, a diode periodic table on the internet, and go to properties, press electron affinity, you'll see it for all its glory there. And it's quite interesting to look, and the king of all electron affinities is chlorine. It gives the most energy out. But there is more difference, that a lot of energy can go there, but how readily it pulls the electron off is a graduated scale. So if you can have two chlorines, and they will share the electrons will actually spend a mid-time between the neutral section. The electrons will be attracted into the centre. That's where they'll be lowest of energy. They'll be into the centre, and you'll have an electron, basically an orb of negative charge, and positive charge is the site of forming a chlorine molecule. And that way the electron is not attracted to one side or the other. But if you, say, add fluorine, so let's start off with lithium. The origin of the word lithium is, they're looking for something, and they said lithium rock. It's sort of a boring name for a chemical. Now, chlorine, because it had a greenish colour, chloro is some sort of Greek for green. Fluorine, again, is beneath in group 7 or 17, I prefer 17, of the periodic table, the extended periodic table. That is in the halogens, and it's just beneath chlorine, and that's called fluorine because its compounds of it were added to mixes to make them melt and make them flow. Fluorine was named after because it could flow, and all things with an ene in it are part of that special group. Just to give you an idea, gen means may. So hydrogen means hydro, water. Gen maker of water. Oxy. Not all chemistry makes sense. Oxy was acid. Oxygen means maker of acid. Now, that theory sort of petered out as they worked out what acid really were. But that's the origin of those words. So, we've got something called electron affinity, but we also have electronegativity. Now, electronegativity is not based on measurement. It's a qualitative, well, it is based on measurements, but its scale is not linked to some sort of dahyad SI unit. I can't churn the handle a long time and get you an electric charge. I can't churn the handle and get you a mass out of it if I tried really hard. But this one, electronegativity is a scale. You know, sort of like, I don't know if anyone remember Dudley Moore movies. New York City. Dudley Moore, when he was coming along, and there was, this woman who was 10 rated, and he had a rating scale of 0 to 10. Well, there is a similar rating scale for, not of attractiveness, but of, how well, if you stick two atoms in a box, and you open it up, you know, how strongly one would rip the electron off another. And so, this is electronegativity. And, so, electron affinity, when you look at it, you will see patterns there. So let's go back to electron affinity one moment first. So when you look at the periodic table, you will see, when you look at the electron affinity, not one periodic table, but four periodic tablets. You'll see electron affinity being repeated again and again and again. It's the S block. That's the 1 and 2 for the transition metals, which is called the D block, for diffuse lines. For the P block, it's for principal lines. Those things, you'll see the electron affinity being having a low around, or I think manganese around there, and a low around nitrogen, and a low. You'll see it repeated. You'll see the patterns, and these are the meta patterns of the periodic table, which appalls me as a teacher, because there's prescribed patterns that the students are to see, and if they see anything else, they don't get marked. But if they see the prescribed patterns, which is the general sweep of not a very not the brightest of teachers have said, look, there's these prescribed patterns, and if you can see the deeper patterns, it allows you to get into deeper chemistry. No, don't do that, that's not them. But, so, electron affinity, electron negativity is a relative scale, 0 to 4, and the most electron negative is fluorine, and the most electron positive is, or the lowest electron negativity is francium, around up there. I'm sure, yeah, I think francium would be, that's the extreme bottom left-hand side of the periodic table. So francium doesn't hold its electron very well. And so, if you put the two together, the electron would be right across, on the, fluorine. It's a dipole transition moment. So basically, any two chemicals you select can be a bit salty. A salt means it's an ionic bond, and something is very salty if it's like sodium chloride, but you can get other things, other mixtures, which have salt characteristics. And there we come into the story of a non-metal is something which we consider inert and sort of powdery, and a metal we consider silvery, and it shares its electrons. But a salt is a combination of a metal and non-metal. A salt necessarily, you can't have a salt of one element. A salt has to be two elements. You can select any two elements in the periodic table, and basically, you can get pretty much a salt out of it. And have to think of it for a little while. There are other things in the periodic table. Now, why do I talk about salts? Well, sodium chloride is salt, but depending on how many bonds are available, you can actually make that into quite an interesting thing. It's not necessarily, sodium chloride is definitely iron, and there's no way that you can build it up to do anything else. But if it's got a couple of bonds each, can bonds actually in a complicated way, it can actually sort of have slightly complicated bets each way. And, magnesium chloride is a salt. Magnesium oxide is a salt. Aluminium oxide is a salt. In fact, it's a flocculant. I think it's aluminium sulfide. Aluminium oxide. Is it aluminium? Aluminium chloride. The aluminium chloride is definitely a salt. And it's what you throw in pools and refine them out. And it sort of changes the water, creates a gradient for gunk to actually flocculate. You throw it into a cloudy pool, and your pool will be absolutely stunningly crystal clear. Reminds me to clear my pool just in front of me. So that's salt, aluminium chloride. Aluminium oxide is a powder. In fact, aluminium oxide is the stuff that forms on the surface of your aluminium and stops it bursting into flame, unless you happen to be the Falklands War and an Argentinian plane fires a missile furnished and paid for by the French as a marketing thing called an exocet, and blows up and it heats up so much. You can heat something so much up that the oxide layer can't form and detect it, and you have something called a metal fire. So the aluminium can burn, people are well aware that magnesium can burn, which is another example. And this is one of the things to think about, that we are seeing by far the most abundant. So all the iron and nickel and heavy stuff is sunk down to the core of the earth. Let's talk about the earth world. Then it's iron and sulfur, and then not much iron, about 5% iron. Even though you think iron's everywhere, there's not much iron. And it's mostly magnesium, which is a light metal. Magnesium's in group 2, under beryllium, there. Magnesium, oxygen, and silicon forms the vast majority of the rock inside of Earth, which happens to be a gemstone. We're actually sitting, our Earth is a gemstone of this ovaline stuff. Now, it's pretty yucky, so there's lots of other stuff in there contaminated, but if you get this pure Earth, and it's this fairly to me, icky. I find it unattractive, but I'm sure people could wear the right dress, you know, with white satin, that would really show ovaline and optical properties. I think that's magnesium oxide and chlorine, not silicon oxide. There's a bit of sand in there as well. So that's magnesium salt. So we're a big salt crystal, so to speak, sitting up there. That is, as soon as you get a non-metal, which is like oxygen, and a metal, you form a salt, sodium chloride. But we're talking about aluminium oxide, which is the surface of non-stick fry pans, thick anodized layer, and you can actually drive oxygen deep. You can, the aluminium, you can actually pull the oxygen in and push oxygen ions deep and form a nice thick layer. Now, this stuff is powdered stuff. I don't know whether you use aluminium oxide to, I think it's, you use different pastes in your mouth for polishing, but it's definitely a polishing paste. Very white powder. It's only white because it's so small. Similar to like zinc oxide. Zinc oxide's a salt, it's so small, but it can form and it can scatter light and get rid of your UV rays get bounced off. It's sort of like putting a cloud layer right in front of your face in terms of my scattering there. But aluminium oxide is an important thing. It's a beautiful powder. Now, if you get this powder together, you'd see a little salt crystal of aluminium oxide, very small, but it's such that it can be quite strong, but also brittle, so it breaks off and it tends to scour the surface. So that's, a lot of people get aluminium oxide as polishing powder for cars. I think that's where you use it to take a very small layer of your Duco off. You want to know what you're doing to polish it up. And you basically abrade your car. When you polish something, obviously, you polish something, what are you doing? Well, you're removing dirt, that's washing it. But to polish something, you actually have to cut down that surface layer of grime, move it away. Aluminium oxide. But we are going to do something with that aluminium oxide and make our first ceramic. And how do you make a ceramic? Well, you get powdered in generally clay. Clay, now let's see, what does clay mean? Clay means nanoparticles. Sand means microparticles. Clay just means basically a nanoparticle oxide. And what happens here is that you heat it up and the very tiny volume means a huge surface in it energy. Because it's really small, the surface energy is less defined and it can actually melt on the surface, and two particles can actually be stuck on the inside and melt on the outside. So it's a bit like making, and this is called sintering, and you can actually add contaminant to the outside of it. So this is with sandstone, which is, well, the sand is much bigger, but that has iron dust with it, and when that heats up, it melts the surface of it. And sandstone is basically glass particles with, sorry, quartz particles with a glass growing on the outside of it. So a disordered point. And so a ceramic is a key thing. It's the nanoparticles, which has been sintered. So this is definition 101, what a ceramic is. It has been sintered, and the surface, because it's a very small particle, it's a huge surface area, the energy on that is different. It's a surface energy. And this means that surface bonds to the next thing. So it's sort of like you've got some cough lollies. You take it out, but before you take it out, you cough. And you say, oh, no one knows it. And you leave it there. And the surface of the cough lollies dissolve a bit and become a bit sticky and then dry out again. And then next winter, you come in, it's all okay, it's all dried out. You pick up your cough lollies and it's all one glob Now, of course, this is what happens with the aluminium oxide. You get the aluminium oxide as a powder, and you put it in a mould, and you heat it up to just the right temperature, and this forms a ceramic, pure, like a pottery ceramic, but only aluminium oxide. We're talking about, these are sort of chemical ceramics, and it forms a little piece of pure aluminium oxide saucer, a cup, a little mini teacup, like a mini fairy teacup is what we use in chemistry as, well, we can use sort of clay ceramics, which you have in glasses, but in general you can get a pure aluminium oxide ceramic, and this is a quarter refractory piece of ceramics, a little teacup, and it's called refractory, because I can heat the bejesus out of it, and generally I put metal in it, and I can heat that metal way above melting temperature. Now, of course, you have to be sensible. You don't heat a piece of aluminium or magnesium, because the oxygen won't go with it. But if it's at high temperature, it still doesn't want oxygen, you can heat it up. So you can heat up metal or something like that. It's called refractory stuff. So we had to know what these were in the early days. So when we wanted to heat up metal to pour the gold, I've raided the gold, and I'm going to, before the sheriff comes around, I'm going to remelt all my gold and form it into, you know, stolen coins, into crockery and things like that. Where's the gold? Oh, not around here. Hey, what's that you're eating with? Oh, that's, it's gold. And so, that process was required the development of refractory ceramics. So, El Cheapo stuff out of China and India, ceramic pottery you have in the school lab, is actually clay pottery. I don't know how much. I'd be lucky if, I don't know what temperature it goes up to, like, old, hot, but bloody cold, in relative terms. The next, sort of, the bargain basement one is, aluminium oxide, and it is made by heating it up, and I think you may put it under a little bit of pressure. You certainly don't let it blow around the place and heat it up, it's gotta be put in a mold, got a reasonable pressure. Heats up. And you let it cool down really slowly, because aluminium oxide has a large thermal coefficient of expansion. That's a boron nitride. Oh yeah, sorry, I've just got to get in my head. So that's aluminium oxide. So that's your relatively cheap thing, but it's, although it's cheap, it's a bugger to really operate quickly, because you've got to heat it up really slowly, heat it cool down really, you have a gentle surround. It's okay for a furnace, you know, you've got a potting kit. Well, example of something which has to heat up and cool down, pottery is an example which doesn't have a good thermal shock process, so you've got to get it up into the kiln. Pottery is just not aluminium oxide, but it's other things, other feldspars and basically silicon metal bit in your pottery, and you could heat it up and then bring it down really slowly over hours, so it goes down, because if you bring down one section it will blow apart. If you wanted to destroy a piece, something like that, you'd get one of those little pickaxe heat points which can get, you know, really high temperature in a few millimeters, and thermal shock's not something to laugh about. Someone had swapped a glass slide, I had a quartz slide, someone came in, nicked it, borrowed it, came back, and with a plain glass, flat glass slide, it sort of looked a bit different. I'd said it looked a bit green, whereas quartz is, pure quartz is bluish colour, but I put this heat axe, this little heat thing on to melt a little sample on top of it, and it exploded, like it's like this whip crack. It was a noise as if you couldn't imagine for such a small little thing. Obviously it's a flat plate, and the heat shock going in there. So aluminium oxide is not the best for heat shock. You go around the periodic table. What else can I go? And zircon. Sounds a little zircon. So under titanium, aluminium, you go next thing, you get titanium. So it goes titanium, zirconium, hafnium. Hafnium is a bit rarey, but zirconium, zircon is your fake diamond. So zircon oxide is there, but you can actually get this powder up relatively easily and sinter it together and make essentially the same thing at zircon oxide. Now the other thing is that these things, whereas aluminium oxide is a bit fragile, this is bloody strong, and to make it stronger still, you can actually add in something which de-stresses the actual particle, the actual link between the nanoparticles. So basically you've got zircon oxide, it's ground into a very small paste. It's actually like, say if I've got a block of chocolate, I keep on cracking it. So I've got the little chocolate bits, and then I just put them together and melt them a little bit. So you can add something to it, which is my favourite element, or one of my favourite elements, is yttrium, which is under scandium in the actual rare earths. So rare earths are these elements which have the property, they're metals, like sodium reacts with water, magnesium reacts with water a little bit, I suppose, if you've got the oxide layer off it, and then the next one, or going down, you've got potassium, calcium definitely bubbles away with water. Scandium will react with hot water, not cold water, hot water. You can see it react, forms of it. Yttrium's underneath it, and you add a little bit of yttrium oxide to the zirconium oxide. So this, I'm just telling you that to go. Now I have actually forgotten the origin of the word. Titanium means from Titan strong, zirconium. I've got to remember what the name of that one is. I have to go back and remember that. But you add those two together and you make something relatively hard. And these are really hard ceramic balls, which are the balls that you put in back in to your milling machine to mill everything else, because it's really super hard and shock resistant, thermally resistant, and look, there's so many fascinating things. I just can't describe the fascinating things of these ceramics. Getting back to there's optical properties, the milkiness of these ceramics, the my scattering of them, and their fluorescence in UV light is just a fascinating thing to really look. These are insulators. There's an electron would just have a scratch its head working out how the heck am I going to get from here to here. There's no big electron wave functions. It is truly non-metal at its big. It is a salt, a nanosalt, which is got its surfaces melted. Zirconium oxide, and these balls are used for grinding. So if you want to polish something up, right down, you have a mill. So there's no point getting a mill with just flour in it, you know, really soft, because it's sort of like, oh, I'm going to knock down this wall with a feather. You've got to really start, if you want to rock something down, you keep on throwing rocks and eggs at it, and you just don't like it. So it's there, and it's also used in ball bearings. Now, the thing is that the ball bearings, one of the things is you have a grease, and the grease in a ball bearing gets mucky and its viscosity and stuff like that. You can make it low viscosity, but which goes. However, you can actually have dry ball bearings. Look, I might be wrong with this. So I'm just, this is what I've read and understood. So you can have ceramic ball bearings. the ceramics have this thing that they have got a low sticking coefficient. Believe it or not, metal sticks to other metal. It forms a normal metal bonds, and this is basically friction of metal against metal. It's not there in high speed ball bearings. So this effect. So at low speed, it's not going. At high speed, the metal is touching and untouching, and that metal touching metal transfers charges. I suppose if it's the same metal, it might be okay, but I think it's even worse. So there's all this complex stuff. But again, you can actually going through it. Let's go off to your new ceramics. So we're just talking through our ceramics. You can actually get boron nitride, and I suppose it would be, so it's hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron. Boron's on the aluminium, and nitrogen's next to it. Now, I just find this hard to really concentrate and work out chemically if it's working, because nitrogen is something which doesn't really want to form an ionic compound. So adding boron to it's quite interesting. And the boron nitride has this ability that, because of the way it's not pulled together really tightly to start off with, it's soft, but it's also got no thermal coefficient of the thermal coefficient of expansion is pretty low. Just to put yourself into it, Pyrex is this glass. It's Pyrex glass, obviously. But you can actually form glasses with regions of negative coefficient of expansion added with positive expansion and have glass which has got no thermal coefficient of expansion. So what happens is that if you have a high thermal coefficient of expansion, you heat one section on it, that will expand while the surrounding area won't expand, and so this is like actually creating a bomb. You know, these things can blow up. So boron nitride is okay. Now boron carbide is another ceramic. Okay. Now this is an important thing. It's different from, like, a diamond is different from now boron nitride forms planar. I just have to imagine. I can't imagine at the top of my head here. I'm getting a bit out of it. The main aim of this podcast is just to have the periodic table in my head, discuss various things, identify areas, gaps in my knowledge going across. Like, I want to remember remember where the word boron came from, nitra, where that came from. That comes from the nitra region in Egypt. Nitrogen. Gin means making. It's the stuff that makes potassium nitrate gunpowder, and it used to come from that region there. And potassium also, it's got Na from the same region. I'll have to have a look at it and remember what boron used to be, what the origin of the word boron is. So this is all, for me, I'm just trying to remember different things. Boron carbide is something obviously much closer to the to diamond structure and the boron structure, and again I have to think what the crystalline thing. But boron nitride is not; it can be a crystal, and you can use it in little chunks as an abrasive. But as a ceramic, it's again a little powder, nanopowder, and it's bonded on the surface. So boronite. Boron carbide is ceramics, is like your fantastic super ceramics. So this amazes. This is a refractory material. Just imagine, I wonder whether you use boron carbide and rocket engines. There's something we've got really high temperature, right? I'll tell you what, the SpaceX Falcon engines are just something to just drop your jaw on. They're just beautiful to look at. You just go, especially when they're on and you can see the refractory metal and it's just light and all that thing. So one of the great things about ceramics, it gives you high temperature, low mass. People can pick up a stack of plates. They're so light mass. That's plates, sorry, pottery. They put glass on the surface of it, and all that type of stuff. So boron carbide. I've got to remember there. But the real ceramic, which is something to be joyous about. And now you've also got the ceramic seals, you know, where you get metal to ceramic seals, where you actually get glass which bonds with the metal and then bonds with the ceramic. That's something to really speculate and sort of think about. That that's something really quite amazing. Only in metal ceramic bonds, you know, how does that happen? And there's used to be a little group in CSIRO which really got into it, and making ceramic for all these they've got sort of extraordinary properties, ceramics, but then they're also hard to manufacture. They're something which is super hard, and say, well, you can't get up to it with a pair of pliers and bend the ceramic. We used to have heaps of fun with optical fibers. There'd be these ceramic printed circuit boards, right, to allow it to take very high temperature, and we use that ceramic to cut, score our optical fibers higher than glass, cut them all the time. That's just, you sort of lament that. It's so much easier than sticking this device and actually running a diamond tip around the surface. And, you know, ceramic, you can actually scratch glass and all that type of stuff. So, but the other brilliant thing is boron lanthanide. So it's such a thing. Lanthanum, they've all got a typical lanthanum is a rare earth. So lanthanum comes from the hidden. I.e. all these elements, the lanthanides, are the rare earths, and the F block down the bottom there. And again, the boron lanthanide is just a dream ceramic. Sort of just, so get for it. You're used to ceramics being pretty plate like, so you can get instantly a feeling that this does not conduct electricity, but boron lanthanide is a ceramic which does conduct electricity, and also it doesn't hold its electrons particularly well, and so it's ceramic. It's got the property of high temperature, and also can get electricity off it, and also you can actually run a current through it. So this is this thing of, if I'm building a high vacuum, so ceramic means high vacuum, I can clean it to buggering, I can put acid on it, really clean it up, I can actually iron bombard it, clean it up with an argon discharge. You put an argon into your system, reduce the vacuum, and then run a glow discharge that creates argon star, highly reactive. So you can clean it up. You make this beautifully, beautifully clean, conductive surface, which can be polished to a sharp tip. And so, for all this electron machining, boron lanthanide is an amazing thing. So, that gives you a view of ceramics, a view of it all there. For me, it's tipped through my head So walk through. Got to remember the name, the origin of the name of a few elements. Lanthanum. I've got to see if I can describe that a bit better. But it's good now that I've memorised the periodic table. And I've memorised these things, and as I'm reading back, I'll have to get on top of these things. And it's good, perhaps, that you know now what ceramics is. Ceramics, salt, nano, sintered. Bejesus, that's what it is. So it's anisotropic. It doesn't have, because it's sintered, each crystal that's put in there doesn't have a cleavage plane. Or it does, each crystal has a cleavage plane, but it's a really tiny cleavage plane. And it has the ability to put in grade properties. I can well imagine that you build up your ceramic, and that just the last bit of ceramic, you dust your mould with something, and you could have a surface layer of stuff. There's heaps of things I like to do in ceramics. It's a fantastic material, and you need to know it. And can you access it with standard school chemistry? Well, if they don't teach you electron affinity and they don't teach you quantum mechanics, you're condemned to a life of rote learning. And essentially, the moment that you forget things, you're sunk. So thanks a lot for listening. That's 46 minutes on this one. I'll have to go off and read on to my next World Atlas of Cheese. Thanks a lot for listening on ceramics.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.